Wanted to give you all a little bit of encouragement because this has been a really difficult message for me to prepare, and it's been a long and difficult week for me trying to balance bar prep with sermon prep. But I will say that you folks are easy to serve. It really was a labor of love, and if there's any congregation that you know could pull me away, it would be y'all. Carmen was insistent that I let you know that should I not pass, foregone wages will, you know, be your responsibility. So, no, we're all going to pass. Good morning. It's nice to be here with you. I'll never forget my first garden. It was the spring of 1999. I was 14. My grandfather had died the summer before. And as the resident family bibliophile, lover of books, I found myself the recipient of his small but respectable library. Of course, all the books were old. The photographs were in black and white. There were no dust jackets on most. But the few that remained spoke of simpler times when dust jackets evidently had advertisements for baking soda on them. So I guess they had the extra space, so why not go ahead and use it? And like a 25% price tag. These were old books. Most of them had to do with agriculture of some kind. I remember one title. It was On the Proper Care and Maintenance of Small Farm Equipment. So you just don't see great titles like that anymore. And you don't have to wonder about what's in the book either. There was another one on poultry husbandry. It's a legitimate field, folks. But me, with no poultry or tractors to speak of, I gravitated towards the ones that I could get my hands on, which is the books on vegetable gardening. And I remember devouring the books over the winter of 1998, and I decided that spring that it was the Lord's will that I should be a vegetable gardener. So, if you know me at all, you know that I'm a rabid, compulsive planner. So I drew all these sketches of what the garden was going to look like on, you know, it was to scale, it was on graph paper, it was probably like at least 26-pound paper. I mean, it was good stuff. And it was just all sketched out in my head. It was just meticulously planned out. And having done this planning, I was, you know, ready for the first thaw where I could actually work the soil. And I distinctly remember the first day as well, that day when I broke ground, scraping off the top layer of sod, and my pleasure at meeting a healthy group of earthworms, which is a good indicator of good soil. And I discovered that I had inherited good sandy loam, which is important. I got the first set of blisters, and it's certainly the first time I'd ever looked on dirt with much appreciation. But as the weeks wore on, however, I discovered why most eighth graders prefer video games to vegetable gardening. It's because it's hard work. There's not a lot of instant gratification. Bermuda grass is not stopped easily. And all the idyllic pictures of people out there working their garden in long sleeves and not sweating must have been taken from vegetable gardeners in Vermont, because it doesn't work that way in East Texas. And also, having never tasted a homegrown tomato from my own garden, I wasn't able to dream about that and so get down in the soil and actually work it. I wasn't able to have that hope. So I learned my first and what would be many, many life lessons that first year. This is the way that I articulated in my mind, that anyone can be a gardener on March 15th. That's not when you test your mettle as to whether or not you're going to be a successful gardener. Successful gardening instead demands a long-term view. You've got to have a clear vision for the future. You've got to know what you're up against. You're going to have to know what it's going to take. Another way maybe to think about it is that the weeding that you have to do in May is drudgery if you can't look forward to June. You've got to have an eye for the future. And it's kind of a buzzword, but begin with the end in mind. All those things, that's what I'm getting at. So no doubt you're asking yourself, self, what does this have to do with Philippians 2? I was just about to get there. Today, of course, we're going to talk about what it means to work out your salvation. And the original word from which work out is translated has this agricultural tone to it. So when you think of weeding and cultivating and bringing forth and working manual labor, it really has that sense, which is really instructive for us, that it is, in fact, work. That's assumed that the Christian life is going to be work. So I think that that provides some helpful insight into what it means to work out your salvation. That is, that we need to think about the end game of our salvation. That's the connection with the gardening. Is that when we think about that work that we do, that real, sometimes literally, manual labor that we do in the Christian life, that we do that in expectation. We look forward and we see a future reality that has not yet come. And our text today is going to provide that future vision. Not only that, it's going to show us how that we can look forward and see, again, this future reality that has not come about, but it's also going to give us a couple of striking examples of different ways that you can work out your salvation. The first example is going to be the ancient Israelites whenever they came out of Egypt and they wandered in the desert. They did not work their salvation out in fear and trembling. They worked their salvation out in pride, in arrogance. They looked at their deliverance that had just been accomplished for them by God out of Egypt, and they demanded comfort and material blessing. They were the original entitled people. And the second example, in stark contrast to ancient Israel, is Paul, who worked out his salvation in light of the future with the blessed end in mind. That is, in worshipful deference to God, and he worked his salvation out with fear and trembling. And the difference between the two approaches is just as obvious in the text, I think, as it is in the garden, where Israel couldn't see past the present. All they could see is their material blessings, the fact that they were hungry. And the result is that their salvation never got worked out. It never came to fruition, and it rotted on the vine in the same way that a tomato might rot. But Paul, instead, he worked out his salvation with fear and trembling. Again, worshipful deference, submission to the Lord. And his salvation worked itself out in time, and it ripened. It became what it should have been, what salvation needs to become, and what it can become for us. So let's go ahead and go to the text. Again, it's Philippians 2, verses 12 to 18, and I'll read. Therefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, so now, not only is in my presence, but more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. For it is God who works in you, both to will and to work for his good pleasure. Do all things without grumbling or disputing, that you may be blameless and innocent, children of God without blemish in the midst of a crooked and twisted generation, among whom you shine as lights in the world, holding fast to the word of life, so that in the day of Christ I may be proud that I did not run in vain or labor in vain. Even if I am to be poured out as a drink offering upon the sacrificial offering of your faith, I am glad and rejoice with you all. Likewise, you should also be glad and rejoice with me. Would you please join me as we come before the throne of grace? Father in heaven, Lord, you are good. You are perfect in every way, and you have always been perfect in every way, and you will always be perfect in every way. You reign over all things. Nothing is outside your will. We cannot fully comprehend the wisdom of your mighty acts, but we want to know you more. We thank you that you have promised to work alongside us as we strive to be more like your Son, Jesus Christ. Please continue to work within us for your good pleasure, which should be our ultimate goal. We confess that we are not easily satisfied with the blessings that you have given us. We always want more, and we always want it now. Please forgive us for not trusting your promises. The blood of Christ that you have applied to us who trust in you has caused us to be without any blemish. And yet we struggle with our practical holiness. Please help us as we pursue your will and seek to have the mind of Christ Jesus. Send your Holy Spirit to us now that we might better understand your word. With his help, we are able to know you. Life is hard, Lord. Please fill our hearts with the joy of your salvation, even when we do not care to rejoice. Strengthen our faith and our love for one another. Please continue to build Redeemer Community Church into a community of people who can show your love to the world. And please protect us from the evil one who is powerless in your presence. We are able to ask these things because we have been united with Christ. There is no other name by which one can be saved, nor is there any other name through which we can approach your throne of grace. Amen. Okay, so we're going to start with, of course, there's two sections here. The first is verses 12 and 13, and the rest is 14 through 18. Are there two more important verses about what it means to live our lives as Christians? I would challenge you to find them. I don't know of any. These are really important. This is not where I'm going to spend my time. It's where I could spend my time, but I feel like that we're probably okay here. But there is a needle, obviously, that needs to be threaded anytime that you're talking about working and salvation. So let me see if I can thread it in about 45 seconds. The first thing that's obvious here is that this word work, again, with this agricultural context, I hope that you haven't succumbed to the cult of let go and let God, but you shouldn't if you did, because there's not really much evidence for a Christian life being anything like let go and let God. Amen. It's just not a helpful way for you and for me and for anybody to think about the Christian life. The critically important counterpart to that is that, this is where you have to thread the needle, is that we don't work because we think it makes us right with God. That is, being a Christian is an intense effort on your part, but the process of becoming a Christian is not an effort of your own. Our work, that is, working out our salvation, is about perfecting our salvation, what we already have, bringing it to fruition, bringing it to harvest, making sure that it ripens. Now, it's not about keeping our salvation, and it's certainly not about securing our salvation, something that we cannot work for. If you are a Christian, it's because God stopped you on your way to hell, and he warmed your heart to Jesus Christ, and he applied Christ's righteousness to you, and that's the only reason that you have any salvation to work out in the first place. But there's much more going on in the section, but I think is probably more helpful for us. I think that we've got that. You wouldn't be here if you felt like that you would work out yourself. I probably wouldn't be here. So, but anyways, that is something important to remember. So we're moving forward. Look at verse 12. We begin the section with therefore, and as careful Bible readers, of course, you know that therefore is going to indicate that what follows is rooted in the verses that came before. So your immediate reaction as a good, astute Bible reader would be to go back and read what it's there for. So we need to look back at what came before those verses leading up, which is, of course, real high point, even probably in the New Testament, this great story of how Jesus Christ came in humble submission to the Father. Because he took the low road, because he took the difficult road, and the road of humiliation, God ended up exalting him. But what does that have to do with our salvation? Again, that therefore is there so you know that it matters to what we're talking about today, which is working out your salvation. And the wonderful truth that you need to take away today, one of the main things, is that taking the humble road today, you can leave and you can take that humble road, that low road, and know that that will, you are promised that that will result in your future exaltation. If you take the low road today, you will one day walk the high road. And that's not because you deserved it. That's because that's the way that God has set up things. So that is what the therefore is there for. And I just had to throw that out there for the K. Arthur devotees in the audience. See, that is really the great irony of the way that God, that really the irony of the cross, and it's the irony of the way that things work in God's economy, where, and that is why the gospel, there's nothing like the gospel. There's no other religion that could have had this idea. There's nothing else like it. It's counterintuitive. There's no way for us to reason to it, where you get greatness through suffering or fullness through emptiness. No other religion, no other thought process is like that. It's inconceivable. It doesn't make logical sense, and it's not something that we can observe. God just told us that that's the way that he works. And of course, our lives and human experience does not work that way. But as we work out our salvation, we know that this great irony that you get greatness through humility, that you get to go to the high road because you took the low road, that is, whereas though it is the exception in today's world, it doesn't happen very often. It's the rule in God's world, in God's economy, and that's how it works. The rule on earth, we could probably say, is success through selfishness and gaining, and only pursuing what you need for yourself, but that's not how it works with God. God cannot change, and he has not changed what he values. This irony indicates this something fundamental about God, and like I said, this hasn't changed. In the same way that Christ was exalted for taking the low road, so will we be. I was just struck, I'm not much for rhetorical questions, but how much less burdensome does this make the otherwise very difficult task of taking the low road, of thinking less of yourself than you do think of others, of intentionally, of almost in the way that Christ did, of emptying yourself of your desires, of your needs, and pursuing others as greater than yourself, of being others-centered. It is this, if we can grasp this great truth, it is of great help to us in doing that. And to take it back to the garden, I think it really is, it is difficult, again, to weed the soil in May if you cannot taste the harvest in June. It seems futile. But if you can taste the future, if you can look forward and you can suck it up for a while, then there is great blessing. And I think that's exactly what we need to take away from that, therefore. And then there's another truth that I want to hit. In verse 13, it is God that works in us both to will and to work for his good pleasure. God is not only there. I mean, we see this picture of God's sovereignty. And it's not only that God is over, he is sovereign, of course, over our salvation in delivering it to us, into securing our salvation, but also he is sovereign in our salvation as we work it out. He exercises his control and his authority. That's what it means for him to be sovereign over every aspect of our Christian life. And I think it's fascinating here that when Paul wants to make you work, when he wants to drive you to action, where does he go? He roots that, he grounds that in God's sovereignty, which is striking, and that's not the way that we typically think. We often tend to kind of struggle like, God's sovereignty, human responsibility, I don't really know how it works out. Paul's like, no. I mean, God controls it and you work. There, that tension, I don't know, maybe he just, you know, pre-enlightenment thinker, or I don't know, he'd never heard of self-esteem, or I don't know, but there doesn't seem to be this tension in Paul's mind. God controls everything. Work your tail off. It's very clear. So that is, we are encouraged in our working because we know that we don't work alone. If you're paralyzed by your inability to understand sovereignty and responsibility, again, you're not taking your cues from the Apostle Paul. And earlier, I defined sovereignty as control and authority, kind of two sides of the same coin. That is, we typically, when we think of sovereignty, we typically think of might, of control. But there's also this other aspect of sovereignty where you have right. So might and right. That God not only has control, he has the power to do what he wants, but he has the authority. God is the final stamp. He is authoritative. What he says goes. That is, the God who works in you, which is what Paul has just promised, is the one whose approval that you seek. So as an example that I thought of, and I think it's helpful. So imagine that you had entered the county fair with this contest to see who could make the best peach pie, which is, incidentally, my favorite dessert, peach pie. The contest was going to be on a Saturday, but on Friday night, you had the chance to sit down with the one who would be judging the pie eating contest, and he got to lay out, look, I like a crust like this, I like fresh peaches, we need, you know, this much meringue, and this and that. That is exactly the picture you need to think about with God, is that you don't have to wonder about, number one, we don't have to wonder about what God's expectations are for us because they are laid out, but you also are assured that if you'll do that, he's going to like it. That the approval is promised, it's sealed, that he will, that he works in us, and if we work alongside, what we do will be approved by the God of the universe. So let's put this stuff together. Okay, so when we work out our salvation with fear and trembling, we know that we are walking the same road towards future exaltation that Christ walked. Living life in light of the gospel is living life in light of the fact that the gospel is good news because the people who believe it will become co-heirs with Christ of the entire universe. That's why it's good news. And as we are strengthened in our pursuit of holiness with the knowledge of our future exaltation, we are further encouraged by the truth that God is working in us towards a future goal that is specifically designed and already pre-approved by him, which is helpful. All right, let's make the transition. The last four verses of our text today are going to show us two radically different ways of working out your salvation. You have, again, ancient Israel coming out of Egypt in the wilderness, who transformed their salvation into an entitlement program. And you have, second, Paul, who correctly understood that salvation is not about us, but salvation is really about God. So verses 12 and 13 provide us with a big picture view of our growth in godliness. From them, we learn that growing in godliness is an active rather than a passive activity, and we are able to determine the ultimate end goal of our growth. We will enjoy the sort of exaltation that Christ currently enjoys. We're also able to see that our belief in God's sovereign control and authority over our sanctification means that we need not worry about how to please God. After all, the one who works within us is the one that we're working to impress. Okay, so I think we got that. All right, let's look at verse 14. Do all things without groaning or complaining. Those are slightly different words. When you think of the groaning, it's like the murmuring or muttering or grumbling sort of under your breath. The complaining is what I would say is a little bit more high-handed. It's kind of like arguing back to God, disputing, arguing. I scoured the original Greek text, Abe, you'll like this, every English translation that I could find, and never, ever is complaining translated as litigating. So you're all right. So the Lord clearly, by that, is okay with that process. So makes me feel better in Carmen, too. When you see complaining, I mean, you should always be reading your Bible looking for allusions to things that have happened in the past, because that happens a lot. When you see complaining and grumbling, your first inclination should be to go back and be like, oh, I know a great example of some folks that complained and grumbled, and those were the ancient Israelites, the ultimate complainers. I'm going to read just a few verses from Exodus chapter 15 and 16 that kind of lay this out, what was going on with the Israelites after they had gotten out of Egypt. So Moses brought Israel from the Red Sea, and they went out into the wilderness. And they went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. And the people complained against Moses, saying, "What shall we drink?" So he cried out to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a tree. And when he cast it into the waters were made sweet. And then the next chapter, chapter 16. Then the whole congregation of the children of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. This is like the next day or something. And the children of Israel said to them, "Oh, that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the pots of meat and when we ate bread to the full. For you have brought us out into the wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger," after he had just rescued them from 400 years of slavery. That's how quick it took for them to complain and grumble. And that was their grasp on what salvation meant was, well, yeah, but what are we going to eat? I don't like this food. I want it to be better. I mean, the slightest hint of struggle or frustration suffering, they were out. Now, your initial reaction to that is disgust. Your very, very close second reaction should be caution, which is, we are them. And that should, anytime, I mean, you know, Israel is, you know, put there as an example of a people that, I mean, it should be a great encouragement to you that God could possibly love Israel any more, you know, after the first few hundred times that they messed up. That should be a great, you know, that God's love is not based on how good that you're doing. Because we know that even though that we are not the most of us are not the biological sons and daughters of Abraham, that we are the biological sons and daughters of Adam. So, I mean, the same opportunities that Israel messed up, we are going to mess up. We are prone also to work out our salvation for what it presents to us in a material way right now. We talk about entitlements a lot, and I've used that word a few times, but that is not a modern phenomenon. That is not LBJ's fault or welfare's fault, or, you know, that's not a function of the New Deal. People have always felt entitled. You give them a little bit, that's part of what it means to be human. You get a little bit and you want more, and then you begin to expect it. So we have to examine ourselves. I mean, it's a personal rebuke to us to watch out for that spirit. But I think that Paul's thinly veiled allusion to Israel is even more specific than that because of what was going on at the church in Philippi. As you know, the church at Philippi was in pretty good shape. Paul does not have the sort of rebukes ready for the Philippians that he does for other people. But there may have been some dissension, and you can see that in other parts of the book. Of course, remember in a few verses back in chapter 2, "Complete my joy by being of the same mind, having the same love, Do nothing from selfish ambition, but in humility count others more significant than yourselves. Perhaps indicates that they were struggling with that. But in chapter 4, of course, Paul says, I entreat Euodia and I entreat Syntyche to agree in the Lord. Yes, I ask you also, true companion, help these women who have labored side by side. So you have this issue, evidently, with some disunity in the Philippian church. So Paul, he's very mindful of that. Not clear how deep the divisions were, but they are clearly on Paul's mind. And I think because we often think of innocent complaints, or we think of complaining as innocuous, harmless, and we need to think long and hard about that. Because have you ever noticed the effect that the negative effect that one word can have? And I think that that's with anything, and that is magnified by the fact that Satan understands that. And I believe that complaints almost, for some reason, have the power of the evil one behind them. That they're always as bad. I mean, it always is. It's as detrimental infectious as it can be, because of, again, who is able to focus those where they need to go. The complaints. So, of course, you know, Bob often speaks of keeping the unity of the body through the spirit of peace. And I don't know why this image struck me, but I felt like, or I thought in my mind, that if our goal, if we could keep the unity of the body through being clean, that complaining is like walking up here to the front and taking like a trash can full of cockroaches and maggots and sewage and just dumping it. If being clean was the standard, then that's what you're doing. It's just ruinous. I mean, it's the worst thing that you can do. And complaining is really a direct frontal assault on the spirit of peace. And I mean, you've got to think too, how likely was it that Israel just all of a sudden just spontaneously erupted into a collective whining? No, a couple million folks don't decide at the same time to whine. There was probably that one person. There had to be that one first person who said, gosh dang, oh boy, I'm thirsty. Or I'm not sure if they spoke Yiddish at that point, but oy vey, I sure am thirsty. Sorry, that doesn't help, but I thought of that and couldn't let it go. So the point of that is that there is no innocuous or innocent complaint. And if you ever want to see a great example of this, sign up for the nursery. As an aside, you should sign up to help in the nursery anyways. But Carmen and I have this very strict no profanity, which we think is a good policy, you know, with the toddlers. There's no profanity. The most profane statement of all, I want my mommy. Because that little noxious complaint ruins everything. And you have, after somebody says, I want my mommy, where you can hear, you've got about 4 seconds until you have an absolute insurrection on your hands. It starts off, Grant Hobbs dumps over the grocery cart. It's chaos. Then Aspen starts emptying the hand sanitizer everywhere, and the animal crackers just throwing it in the floor. Now, at that point, you've still got a chance to quell the revolution. But I know it's over whenever Jack Michael begins leading the other kids in this little chorus. Do you hear the toddler singing a song of angry men? It is the music of a people who will not be slaves again. Okay, so it's not quite that bad. It's not. But every complaint, those kids, when they were, you know, they have forgotten about mommy for those few short minutes, and when they remember, it's rough. Just put that image in your mind, because it is just like that with the way that we complain. Every complaint, back up, every complaint has the chance to be the satanic catalyst that destroys Redeemer. And if you love Redeemer like I do, obviously that's a bad thing. We need to avoid that. But it's real serious business. So the next time that you've got a complaint, either swallow it or hang around Keith Tully. Because that dude can smell negative. I mean, in his otherwise demure attitude, start complaining and that dude will get on you like a bulldog. He can smell it a mile away. Before you've even thought it, Keith knows that you're being negative. And he does not like it. So I love Keith. All right. So listen to David's commentary on the Israelites and what they, and their complaining. And this is in Psalm 106. It's really striking. We have sinned even as our ancestors did. We have done wrong and acted wickedly. When our ancestors were in Egypt, they gave no thought to your miracles. They did not remember your many kindnesses, and they rebelled by the sea, the Red Sea. The waters covered their adversaries. Not one of them survived. Then they believed his promises and sang his praise. But they soon forgot what he had done and did not wait for his plan to unfold. In the desert, they gave in to their craving. In the wilderness, they put God to the test. They exchanged their glorious God for an image of a bull which eats grass. They forgot the God who saved them, who had done great things in Egypt. They grumbled in their tents, and they did not obey the Lord. So he swore to them with uplifted hand that he would make them fall in the wilderness, that he would make their descendants fall among the nations and scatter them throughout the lands. And as you know, as good Bible readers, that is exactly what happened, that they were scattered and they failed. Which brings up another point that I want to make that is very helpful for thinking about working out your salvation. Although we will struggle with things like Israel did, that again, the spirit of complaining that is so negative is always knocking at the door. And we have to be vigilant against that. But a very important truth that I think is firmly rooted in the New Testament is that we are not Israel, and the church will not fail, ever. It can't. It will not ever fail. The church will never wander in the wilderness. It will not fail. It will never be conquered. The church will not be scattered. And those within the church, if you're a Christian, you will never lose your position as the children of God. So look at verse 15. Paul commands them to do all these things without complaining. Why? It's just, he's looking to this being blameless, pure, and especially focus in on children of God without blemish in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation. And I want, we could talk a lot about being blameless and pure, but I want to focus your attention on that. Children of God without blemish in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation. If you happen to be reading from the NIV, you'll notice that that phrase is in quotes, and that's because it's a quotation from, or it's sort of a quotation from Deuteronomy 32. Listen very closely to this. This is the song, the so-called Song of Moses at the end of Deuteronomy, where he's pretty much laying it out for Israel, where they failed and what they need to do to fix it. Again, Deuteronomy 32:5. They, Israel, have dealt corruptly with him. They are no longer his children because they are blemished. They are a crooked and twisted generation. Speaking of Israel, they are no longer his children because they are blemished. They are a crooked and twisted generation. What Paul did there, and if you were to go back in the original languages, looking at the Greek New Testament and the Septuagint, which is the Greek version of the Old Testament, that phrase is identical. So Paul goes back, picks this phrase up, that was meant to rebuke Israel, and applies it to the church and just changes blemish to without blemish. You know, you put an A in front of blemish, that's the only change. I mean, that should be striking that this, again, this phrase that was meant to just hail this incredible rebuke on Israel is now applied to the church in a different way. And the church is not the wicked and perverse generation. It's the people that the church is around. For Moses, Israel was a wicked and perverse generation. For Paul, of course, it's the unbelievers in Philippi. Moses rebukes the Israelites for not being the children of God, whereas to Paul, the Philippian Christians are children of God because they are unblemished. And this idea of blemish, you know, we talk about blameless. That's kind of like an above reproach. That's kind of something you can work towards. You can be above reproach. This pure is this idea of like integrity and like that there's not anything mixed in. But this without blemish, this is not like something that you work towards. This is a term of art reserved for people who are perfect and things that are perfect. It's not, again, this is not a function of sanctification. You can't work out this point getting to be without blemish. And can you see why that Israel could never get there? Unblemished is not a measure of your behavior. Like I said, it's a declaration of your status before God. And they could never get there because they depended on animal sacrifices for their purity, which could not work as a category. But the church does not depend on animal sacrifices. The church is without blemish because Jesus' sacrifice was perfect. And we now get to enter in, and how do we refer to God? As Father. Of course, I mean, the Old Testament, how did they relate to God? What was his covenant name? I am that I am. It was this idea of distance. What is the new covenant title? How do we refer to God? Our new covenant title, we don't say Yahweh. We don't say the great I am. We say father or daddy, or Abba, yeah, which is wonderful. This is a critical truth that we have to grasp. If you've been reading ahead in Philippians, you know that Paul is going to rebuke members of the church for requiring circumcision. This is in chapter 3. And do you see the connection between those two things? Those who would require circumcision don't understand that the church is unblemished. They keep trying. I mean, they're outdated. You're outmoded. We don't need to do that stuff anymore. That's not part of it. We're unblemished. We don't have to work on those external things. The church doesn't need to offer any more sacrifices. It doesn't. Anytime that you construct external hoops to jump through to work out your salvation, you are not working it out in fear and trembling. You have forgotten your salvation. You have forgotten what your salvation is, and you are making little of your status as a child of God. You are forsaking that. And Paul has, as we will find in chapter 3, stern words for people who build things on the outside to make them feel like they're godly when they haven't changed on the inside. They're dogs. They're flesh mutilators. They're evildoers. Not a category that you want to find yourself in. And a sobering reminder that hell will, in fact, be full of people with circumcised flesh and uncircumcised hearts. I mean, full. They're just busting at the seams. Hell is going to be full of people who conformed outwardly to a fabricated standard and looked good to their peers. Full. And if you have turned the Christian life into an external contest where you're looking at what you can do on the outside, and you that's where you get your status, that's where you are developing how that you look before God, then you are a member of a wicked and perverse generation. That you have succumbed to the same evil that the Israelites did. You have decided to work out your salvation the way that you want to, just the way that they did, to recreate it and to think that salvation is in some way only tied to material blessings. You have no fear of God. Now you've seen what not to do. Now we're going to transition, and thankfully, I almost lingered too long. We get this encouraging word from Paul, or this encouraging picture of his life, to see what it means to work out your salvation with fear and trembling. Here Paul shows the ultimate forward focus. He's not only able to look at June, but he's able to look at, you know, next year, and he's already planning. He has this incredible forward focus. And I think Paul's focus on the future gives us an incredible picture of what fear and trembling look like. Because Paul wasn't, this fear and trembling idea, this is not that really, what Paul I think was most afraid of is not God. I think he was afraid of a life that wasn't going to matter. Paul worked and he worked and he labored for the gospel because he was afraid of meeting Christ with nothing to show for it. That's what he was really, he did not want to live in vain. That's what he trembled at that idea. That shook him to the core. That's all that he was afraid of. He trembled at the thought of Christ dying for him and then wasting that and doing nothing. I want to, we kind of transition to the close. I want to leave you with this mental picture that I have of Paul that I think it's been helpful for me. I haven't been able to get it out of my mind since I started. Of course, Paul regards his life as a drink offering, and we could go into the specifics of what the drink offering was in the Old Testament, but I don't think it's necessarily important, although it's striking. But it's important at least to get this much, that the drink offering was the last part. It was not the effective. It was not the part of a sacrifice that worked. It was the icing on the cake. It was at the end. It was extra on top. It did not do, it was not what atoned. And I think that's very helpful. Paul thinks less of his own sacrifice, even of his life, than he does of the Philippian sacrifice, even though he is an apostle. He is so encouraged by their faith and their perseverance that he considers his life, even if he should lose it, as of lesser importance than what they're doing. Now, when is the last time that you were so encouraged by the faith of others that you forgot that you were suffering yourself? You were so just impressed and encouraged by what was going on here at Redeemer that you forgot to think about yourself. I don't fall into that category very often. Is your life or death performed in joyous appreciation for the work of others in the gospel? Joy, that's what Paul felt as he was in this process of pouring out his life or having his life poured out for him. So this mental picture that I want to put into your minds. I want you to imagine the most joyous occasion that you can. So it's this grand party, this feast, this ballroom of just like every favorite person maybe that you, that you've ever known, or that, I mean, just the funnest a party could possibly be. Everyone's there. Everyone's, you know, happy. Their drinks are full. Everyone's in good health. They're happy. Everybody's laughing, and there's not a negative thought in the place. And as you eat and you drink and you enjoy the feast, you're so enamored with your surroundings that you tend to slosh your drink, whatever you're drinking, and around, and it is spilling. Perhaps you even spill it on the carpet. Perhaps you spill it on your shirt. Who knows where you spill it? But you don't even notice that you've spilt it, that your surroundings and the situation is so wonderful to you, that you feel so blessed to be there. You're on so much bonus just to be there at the feast that you forget. You don't notice that you've spilt. So that's what Paul did with his life. He sloshed it around and spilt it everywhere. If the cup was in his life, he was so focused on the joy of the gospel and the part that he got to play in it that he spilled his life. And again, he didn't even notice. He did not clutch his life close to his chest. Again, think of this cup. He shared it. He gave it away and he sloshed it around. And when it spilled, he laughed more. He moved about the feast that is a gospel-centered life, empowered life, without any concern where his life blood might fall. And when the cup of his life was finally empty, he was glad to have poured it out, because he poured it out at in a momentous occasion. And even then, again, he didn't notice that it was gone. And I think, again, that just popped in my head, and almost you have this vision of this, like a drunk at a party. I mean, not that Paul was a drunk, but imagine that person, how much they care that they're spilling their drink. They don't really notice, because they're so out of it. And Paul really was out of it for God's glory, that he didn't think that he had, you know, spilled his life everywhere, which is incredible. So now we're gonna transition to the Lord's Supper. We're gonna take communion. And I'd like for you to think about just a couple things. The cup that you'll take today of wine or juice represents another person, not Paul, but of course the Lord Jesus Christ, who willingly and sacrificially offered up his life for others. And the cup is a sober reminder that we get to drink the fruit of the vine, wine or juice. We get to drink, and of course wine in the Bible is a symbol of joy. We get to have joy thinking back on what Christ did. But the cup did not always contain wine. There was a time when the cup was not a cup of joy, that it was a cup of wrath. It was a cup of blood. So that's what the cup once contained. We get to drink wine in celebration because the cup was once filled with blood, and of course that being the blood of Jesus Christ. So as we live our lives as drink offerings offered for each other, we have to remember that that the drink offering, what we're doing, I mean, when we take the cup, that this is bonus, that this is extra. The joy that we're feeling now as we participate in the supper with Christ is of no effect without the original sacrifice. And the original cup, like I said, it was not a cup of joy. It was a cup of blood. It was a cup of death. And that's the only reason that we get to drink now. And today, drink deeply, because you don't have to worry about whether or not the original sacrifice worked, because it did. And we remember that and celebrate that today. So if you are not a believer in the Lord Jesus Christ, I would stridently encourage you to refrain from taking communion. But if you are, whether or not you're a member here or not, feel free to, again, drink and drink deeply of Christ.